Joining me in just a few moments will be Martha Schlamm and Alvin Epstein, who have brought to Philadelphia their performance, A Kurt Weill Cabaret, his Broadway and Berlin songs. Martha Schlamm is a singer and actress. She's performed in Kurt Weill's musicals, she's played the role of Golda in Fiddler on the Roof, and she's performed in one-woman shows. Her performances of the songs of Kurt Weill have received international acclaim. Alvin Epstein has been the artistic director of the Guthrie Theater and the associate director of the Yale Repertory Theater. He has a long list of credits as an actor and director. We'll be meeting them in just a moment, but first let's hear one of Larileño's recordings. Tat, known in English as Mac the Knife, sung by Larileño, a song from the Kurt Weill Bertolt Brecht collaboration The Three Penny Opera. With me is Martha Schlamm and Alvin Epstein, who have brought with them a very wonderful show called A Kurt Weill Cabaret, in which they sing many of Kurt Weill's songs, both those songs written in Germany and songs written in America. They've been together doing this off and on for about 13 years, I understand.
This is the 13th.
And I really wish I could play for you.
Ominous.
I wish I could play for you some of their singing together, but they have not as yet released an album of their own interpretations of these songs, and I hope that someday in the near future they will do that and I'll be able to play it on the show. Well, welcome both of you to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
How did you first get together doing this?
Who wants to take this?
You
me?
Go, Martha. It, well, it was all because of you. You
it was should, all because
it's
of
your
right.
responsibility. Go right. ahead. You explained it if you can.
Well, I did a similar show with another performer, with Will Holt. It was called The World of Kurt Weill. It's a rather presumptuous title. But it was a very great success, that show. And it was a very different show. You see, it was done, I think, 17 years ago, where not so many people had heard of Kurt Weill. In fact, at one of the performances, I shall never forget that, somebody came by and said, is Kurt Weill performing here tonight? You know, I mean, they didn't know who he was. So we introduced him, and we had a lot of information between songs, a lot of patter, a lot of chit-chat, which you noticed there is none of that, except when the show is almost over, we talk a little bit. And Will eventually didn't want to perform anymore. He only wanted to write. And I had an engagement coming up at Ravinia Music Festival and didn't have a partner. And I was working with Mark Epstein, and I told him my sorrowful story.
He's my brother, and he's a director.
He's a director, and I said, woe is me, I have to cancel this beautiful engagement. He said, I don't know, have you ever thought of my brother? And I said, oh, well, your brother is a great actor. Does he sing? And if he did, would he want to do that? He said, well, you don't know. First of all, he's very musical, and he does sing, and you have nothing to lose. Ask him. So I rang Alvin Epstein with my heart pounding slightly because I'd seen him act, and I didn't think he would want to do this.
Associated with this sort
with
of
this, this cabaret, low life.
From the street.
So he was apparently he had had a similar feeling about me because as far as he was concerned, I was a famous folk singer, right? Mm-hmm. So what did I want with him? Just a mere actor. So anyway, I loved his voice on the phone, and I said, if you want this, you've got the job. And we met and talked about it, and your reaction was strange. I mean, at the first he said, well, I'm not an entertainer. I don't think you'd ever done anything like this.
No.
Coming out without...
I acted in plays. I always acted characters. And as a matter of fact, I was well known as a character actor, which means that you even apply more makeup and costume and character tics and mannerisms to hide your own self. And most of the parts that I had done had been of a character nature, so that I was really... I was an actor who loved to disguise myself. And Martha was asking me, A, to sing, which I had never really done a lot of on stage. That is, I've never carried a program of singing, anything like that. I'd been in a couple of musical plays, but always in character, you see. And then also, and then here, you know, to walk out on a stage wearing, at that point, it was a tuxedo, I believe. We were very formal, remember?
Yes.
And just to be out there with my own face hanging out and no character, you know, it doesn't say Alvin Epstein playing so-and-so. It's just Alvin Epstein sings with Martha Schlama. We sing a program.
And what's
so
more?
I was very nervous about that. I did not want to present myself simply as an entertainer.
And the other thing that he hated so was, well, Will...
I didn't hate it. It was unfamiliar territory.
No, Will had written combining, a connecting tissue to the songs, you see, because, as I told you, Kurt Weill, it wasn't all that well known at the time. I mean, there are still people who don't know who he is, but, I mean, there are many more people who, I mean, now the Met has done The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni and Threepenny Opera has been done. But at the time, you know, so we had connecting tissue, so-called. A lot of anecdotes about his life, and it was very charming. I always think of that as the musical comedy version of this show, you see. But the script was written for Will, and Alvin didn't like to have to say these things. So the first time he forced himself, then
memorize it.
Then we had
those,
a return engagement at Ravinia.
The next year.
And Alvin said, I'll do it if you don't make me say those words. So what we did was we had posters, you know, in Brechtian style, war, hate, love,
placards,
jealousy,
you know, placards. Yeah, so we put on an easel.
And then the third time we did the show was when Mr. Brustein asked us to open the Yale Cabaret. And there we decided, well, the kids understand this material very well, and they'll know which is war, and they'll know which is jealousy. We don't have to point it out to them. And we dropped the entire script and said
and
nothing.
And then we began to rearrange the songs so that the songs would have a build and almost a continuous narrative without any introduction, without any speaking in between, so that they would almost... have a dramatic development and almost tell a story that you wouldn't necessarily be conscious of while watching, but you would follow along and understand. And we've been doing that ever since. We've been sort of rearranging and shaping the show constantly.
I wouldn't... Now, as you point out, there's no story around this. There's some connections, but there's no story. You're not acting...
No, they couldn't. They
play.
Couldn't be because the songs are all from different
context.
Works.
But you do assume certain personas for each song, and it's not like acting a role, but there's just a certain feeling that comes across your face, and you can, I can see you. I felt deciding who was singing the song and in what context it was being sung, and it was different from emotional schmaltz. You know, like this is a beautiful song, so I'm going to get a tear in my eye, or this is a lighthearted song, so I'll go. In the middle of it. It was just something very different than you'd find in a nightclub or in someone who's a straight singer who's not an actor and singer. Can you tell us a little bit about your approaches to dealing with each of the songs and what you were going to do with it, how you were going to combine your talents as actors with your talents as interpreters of song?
Yes.
Well, if you're looking at me...
Well, whatever, we can both... We have similar approaches, although... I mean, I was a singer before I was an actress.
And I was an actor before I was a singer.
But even though, I don't think I ever approached a song merely from the musical standpoint. I mean, I would choose a song sometimes because it was beautiful... because it had a beautiful melody, but if I didn't have anything to say in it, I would stop singing it. I didn't know how to sing a song without telling a story, because I was really a very lucky child. I had a singing teacher way, way back in England, an Austrian lieder singer, who insisted on the subtext, which is an actor's term. She didn't use that word, but she would say, "Who is this person? What? How old are you? What's the climate?" I say, "Well, why do you have to know that?" She said, "Because it gives color. When it's hot, you feel differently. You say things differently than when it's cold." So I got acting lessons in my song interpretations without it ever being called that. Do you see?
Mm-hmm.
So I approached the song from the standpoint of the drama. What does it say?
And very briefly, from my point of view, it was that it was a question of approaching it that way simply because I never fancied that I could sing. So I had to act the song. That was the only way I felt secure in approaching a song, because I couldn't trust my voice. And actually, I think over the years my voice has developed, and I'm singing the songs much more as a singer now than I did at the beginning. At the beginning... I didn't feel secure enough as a singer to really rely too much upon the musicality. I was very musical, but yes. That doesn't mean you can turn out beautiful sounds or even musical sounds. It means you have a sense of the music. So I was simply doing what came naturally to me as an interpreter, which was to act the songs. But there is something very particular about these songs, which I think explains... So it is part of the answer to the question, is that the songs are small
dramas.
They aren't narrative songs.
Yes.
They're not merely some sort
formula.
Of outpouring of personal emotion. They usually tell a story. And even when it's very emotional, there's an emotional trajectory. It begins one place, it goes someplace else, and it ends up yet another place. Very, very often that happens.
Yes.
Some of the emotional songs from the German period are emotional, but it's a turbulence, and there's a crudity and a bitterness and a sharpness in back of it. So lyrics themselves never get maudlin. So to act within them is different than to act in a whole evening of love songs or ballads.
Yes, yeah.
Well, they're wonderful songs to do. You see, imagine, Alvin and I have been doing this for over the span of 13 years. We don't do it all the time. We're busy with other things in between as well, you see. But I have done these songs, I opened that show 17 years ago. I am never tired of them. They change, I change, the audiences change. They're little masterpieces, you see, so one is never weary. And as soon as I begin to feel mechanical about anything, we rethink it. Like only last night I was telling Alvin how I felt that I was beginning to be mechanical about something, and I have to rethink the essence of the song. And it was a very good performance last night of that very song that had given me trouble, because I began to say, sometimes, you know, when you do things a lot of times, you begin to be automatic about it, and you suddenly don't hear. I suddenly didn't hear the piano. I didn't hear the wonderful musical lines. Yesterday I heard it again as though it were for the first time.
What did you do to get back into that state of
just,
hearing?
Just
again?
Think it through. You know, just say, come on, don't just say a word, because you're used to saying, I used to believe in the days I was pure, and I was pure like you used to be. Think of what that means without saying it automatically. You see?
Mm-hmm.
And the minute I did that, the song took on life, and I wasn't bored by myself. And I think the audience, they don't ever know, fortunately, I'm touching wood, they're very seldom bored. This is material that doesn't
yes,
bore
even
an audience.
Yes, even when we find that we are a bit mechanical and a bit stale.
Generally
speaking, the audience is not aware of that mechanical quality or staleness. They don't get what you would call a really one of our best performances when that happens, because there is a noticeable difference between a good, solid, established performance and something that's sort of reaching out and going a little bit over the edge in new directions.
And the ideal is every actor dreams of making it happen now as though it were for the first time. That's difficult in a run that goes every night.
Yeah.
But I think we have a very high record of it, because mm-hmm. both of us work this way, and we have a pianist who works this way too. He isn't an ordinary pianist. He is dramatically tuned in. You know, he'll talk about images. Many pianists don't even know what that means. You see, last night, for instance, Lost in the Stars, for me, was a particularly beautiful experience. And I said to Stevie, what was different? Stephen Blyer, who's our pianist. And he said, well, I had a very personal image of it, because he took the credit, which is okay. But you see what I mean? We work with images, and we're lucky that way. So when they fail us, we don't feel so good. But we've achieved, I believe, a certain standard below which we don't go anymore.
I believe you've both worked with Kurt Weill musicals as the whole musical. In other words, outside of the cabaret, Martha, I believe you've done acting and singing within it, and you've done direction.
Yeah,
he's directed.
What's it like at that moment where you go from dialogue into song, which is sometimes a very, very touchy moment, and it's something that you don't have to experience within a cabaret the way you do when it's a theater production and you have the spoken part and the music that has to be combined in just the right balance? What's that transitional moment like? Alvin, as director, what is there something that you aim for to get from the dialogue to the music and have it be right?
I know what you're talking about. I'm not sure that it's an easy question to answer, because I think it depends very much upon, first of all, the performer, the person who's doing it, and then upon the individual work or the individual scene that leads to a song. In the same work, you might have songs that are not well built up to in the dialogue, and others that are, where the dialogue will really carry it to you. I know that as a performer, I think what I'm most instinctively aware of is that when you begin, if you're working with an orchestra, for instance, and you're playing a scene, a spoken scene, and then you come to the music cue and the orchestra begins and you hear that sound, instantly you get a flush of adrenaline that goes right through you, that provides the transition. Then what you have to hope for is that you're acting the scenes on the same level of intensity and of adrenaline. And I have worked with actors when I've directed them directly related to that problem. It's that you mustn't forget that that you are singing songs. I'm thinking now of the Beggar's Opera, where there are so many songs, you know.
78?
Well, there's something like 69 or around 70 musical numbers in it, of which we eventually ended up, I think, cutting about 12 or so. So we still, an enormous number of musical numbers with scenes in between. And those scenes are so often interrupted by music. And the scenes have to be played at a certain level that doesn't suddenly, so that it isn't as if the bottom drops out of the performance. Suddenly there isn't that musical excitement to keep the audience involved. You have to sustain it on a certain level of intensity to carry you to the next song. Otherwise, it's like a very jagged graph when interest rises with music and drops off afterward.
Well, I'm just remembering my first experience when I did the Threepenny Opera when I was a very young girl in London. I had just come out of the internment camp, and in England you don't become English. You stay in your. Nowadays it's different, but at the time, if you weren't British, you know, you were slightly isolated from the mainstream of society. So I belonged to an Austrian youth group, and they did the Drei Groschen Oper, they did Threepenny Opera, and I did Jenny. At the time, Polly. I was very young, I forget. I did Polly. And at that time, Polly got all those beautiful songs. She sang the Barbara song, and she sang Pirate Jenny. And you see how the songs are very related, even though in Brechtian style, the singer sometimes steps forward and sings, completely out of context. All the songs that I had were, for instance, the Barbara song is the explanation to Mr. and Mrs. Peacham why I couldn't say no to McKeith, why I had to marry him, you see, to which Mrs. Peacham says, well, did you have to be so immoral as to marry him? Says, falling in love is one thing, but did you have to marry him? But Pirate Jenny song, what's it called? Seeräuber Jenny, which is usually nowadays sung by Jenny, used to be sung by Polly, and that's a delicious setup, you know, where it's at the wedding in the stable. Where the four guests, you know, the four invited crooks, and McKeith is in a rotten mood, and he says, well, is it going to be another one of these boring days, or is something going to happen? And Polly, who is, you know, very eager to please him, she's the bride, she says, well, if nobody will do anything, I will. And so then she tells this story, and what she says to the invited people, she said, now you can laugh at me, and you hold this bucket, and you pretend to be this person in Soho, and you see. So, and then that song, this bitter, terrible song comes out of this sweet wedding scene. It's just marvelous. To which the musicians, the invited guests say, oh, well, in German they say, das war ja ulkig, that was cute. And McKeith said, don't you know art when you hear art? I mean, it's terribly funny and bitter and sweet. It's the bittersweet quality that I adore so.
Well, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about some of the lyrics and the different translations that have been written for some of Kurt Weill's music. But first I'd like to hear something from the original American cast recording, which included Lauri Lenja, of the Threepenny Opera. She's not appearing on this song that we're going to hear. We're going to hear the Army Song, which is one of the songs that are included in the Kurt Weill Cabaret, a cabaret being performed by my guests Martha Schlama and Alvin Epstein. They've brought it to Philadelphia from New York, where it's been very successful. They'll be going back to New York with it after they leave here. In Philadelphia, it's being performed at the Annenberg Center between 36th and 37th Streets on Walnut Street. So this is the Army Song from the original American cast recording of the Threepenny Opera, and the lyrics for this are translated from Brecht lyrics by Mark Blitzstein.
Johnny joined up and Jimmy was there.
And George got a sergeant's rating.
Don't give your right name, the army don't care.
And the life is so fascinating.
Let's all go Barney, live off the army, see the world we never saw.
If we get feeling down,
we wander into town.
And if the population
should greet us with indignation.
We chop them to bits because we like our hamburgers raw.
Johnny drank up till he's got caved in.
And Jimmy did not drink tea.
And George replied with a right to the chin.
For the army is just a pink tea.
Let's all go Barmy, live off the army, see the world we never saw.
If we get feeling down,
we wander into town.
And if the population
should greet us with indignation,
we chop them to bits because we like our hamburgers raw.
Johnny is missing, Jimmy is dead,
and George went crazy shooting.
But blood is blood, and red is red,
and the army is still recruiting. Let's all go Barmy, live off the army, see the world we never saw. If we get feeling down, we wander into town, and with the population to greet us with indignation, we chop to bits because we like our hamburgers raw.
You see the moon?
That's the Army the Army song from the American cast recording of the Three Penny Opera. That was the first American cast recording, one that included Larilena. I guess if you're just joining us, or Martha Schlemmer and Alvin Epstein, both in Philadelphia, performing the Kurt Weill Cabaret at the Annenberg Center. The lyrics that you sing are a combination of translations. And some of the songs you sing in the original from the German period, some of the songs you sing in the original German. How did you go about choosing which you're going to sing by whom?
We inherited some of those from the previous version of the show that Martha did with Will Holt.
Mm-hmm.
And they're Will's translations, and
some of them are very excellent. Not translations, they're really adaptations.
Yeah.
You know, right, I don't think you can translate these things. Honestly, I don't think.
And that's why, you know, it's sort of ridiculous to claim authenticity for anything. And there are many translations, and there's room for many translations. And then it's up to the individual artist to pick the one that suits him best.
Yes, the very best thing is to do it in the original language. And I used to really insist that they let me do it in the original and do explanations. And people really can follow it once we tell the story, and because we are actors, we could do it. But there are people who really resent not understanding every word. So I think, found a good combination of sometimes. Now, the way Alvin does the Kanonen song is that he sings partially in German and partially in English, and I think that's delicious, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
It's really
because then
strong.
you hear what the song really is supposed to sound like, and even if you don't understand the words, you get the message.
Yeah. That's
then
right.
Then you hear the English words.
For instance, the refrain
and
that
know
says,
"Know why all this is happening?"
Yeah, let's all go Barmy. I mean, that's really very weak compared to Soldaten wohnen auf den Kanonen, which is soldiers live on cannons.
They live right on
right
the cannons.
Right on them, and it's such an image. And also the sound, you see. But I understand that people feel left out. There are people in the audience sometimes who don't chuckle at something that other people do understand, and so they feel left out and We don't
it's
want
a
to
trade-off, a constant trade-off.
Well, a wonderful thing for me, hearing the lyrics that you did sing in German, was hearing German in a different light. Because it's a language that in this country has become very stereotyped because of World War II, I think.
I know.
It's a language that, for me, growing up in the post-World War II period and being exposed to countless World War II movies, is just, the most German I've ever heard is probably little snatches in World War II
and
movies.
And everybody was a moron, right? Every
and,
Nazi
and
war
a killer.
Was a moron.
Yeah,
a killer.
That's right.
And the different kinds of sounds that you get when you sing it in German, and the different nuances of emotion, of anger and bittersweet and sweetness, mm-hmm. is beautiful, and it made help me hear it.
Yes, and what's more, Brecht's German was so exquisite. I don't know if I can quite explain why. It may just be a feeling on my part. Of course, you know, if you read Heine in German, that's not so bad. But Brecht, this combination of colloquial things, you know, things that you don't find in poetry very often. Do you know, like Schuft und Hund, and you know, those Schuft means you heal.
And Hund is,
Hund is your dog. It has these, we don't hear these words. They were taboo in poetry. And here you have poems that use language that the people spoke. And it's very good to say them as an actress.
He has very, very colorful ways of putting things. And sometimes it's a very individual charm of his particular ear, I think.
Yeah.
But there is one thing that I wanted to say about the translation problem. For instance, in the question of how do you choose what you're going to do, we use a lot of Mark Blitzstein's adaptations, which he did for the Threepenny Opera, of which you played the original cast recording just now. And yet we found in one of the songs, the Ballad of Sexual Slavery, that his adaptation was really so, I mean, it seemed to us terribly watered down from the original. And a friend of mine who was a playwright and who also had worked with Brecht, who knew him quite well, George Tabori, at one point did a translation of that song for a concert that we did at Carnegie Hall. And I sang that version of the song, and so I had the lyrics to it. And when we started working on the show, I don't even think
that song was not in the show previously.
We added that. And we added it. And it's a remarkable translation, also very much closer to the German than Mark Blitzstein's, which is not to say that Mark Blitzstein didn't know how to translate. Lots of his are wonderful and the best available, and we do them. But in this individual case, suddenly we found that song was, in George Tabori's translation, it was worth doing. In Mark Blitzstein's, it was not. And, you know, in this other version, this last one.
The one for the New York Shakespeare Festival.
Yes, the New York Shakespeare Festival, where they made a whole new translation. I think the translation was so poor that eventually, it's a three-verse song, they cut all but one verse because it just didn't sustain.
Also, and I think the way we choose also is what's best for us to say, what sounds the best and what's nearest to the translation, to the original, if possible. But I think what was so great about Blitzstein's adaptations or Will Holt's is that he didn't insist, like in Pirate Jenny, he didn't insist to retain the images, because somebody like Bentley, whom I personally love, who made a terrible mistake, he tried to say, "And the ship with 8 sails and with 50 cannons." Well, go ahead and sing that. I mean, the image of the 50 cannons, the white sails and the 50 cannons, is so exquisite. I don't blame him for trying, but if you're very musical, you can't do that. So Blitzstein, here we go, too many Steens in my life, Blitzstein, found another image, which is the black freighter, which isn't bad at all. It's different. It took me years to be able to abandon the other. She's a different person in the American version. Do you know? She really is. That girl in the that talks about the white sails and the 50 cannons, she's both more poetic and more
brutal,
menacing, more brutal. Because she says, when your head rolls, I will say, "Hopla." And you have this feeling like she's a circus instructor that goes hopla when the heads roll. Well, you can't translate that. Somebody said whoopee. I mean, how do you sing that in the middle of that menacing song? You can't say whoopee, right?
Nor is can that you where say, you said that'll learn you?
That'll learn you, yes. Which is a very American thing, or British.
English, yeah.
That'll learn you.
That'll learn you.
But by now, you see, I've made it my own. I used to insist that you can't translate anything, and I still say you can't translate it. You can adapt it.
Can you give us
examples of two of the verses of the song you were referring to before, the way you sing it with the translation written for the cabaret compared to...
I don't know the other translation. Oh, okay. That's the problem. I don't remember it by heart. Do you?
No, I don't either. But it's terribly
weak. It's Mrs. Peachum's song in the Three Penny Opera. And it's in the German, it's called
Sexualis Herrlichkeit.
Yeah, sexual slavery.
Yeah, I know. I remember one phrase where you say lechery.
Yeah.
Blitzstein says dependency.
Oh, yes. It's called the Ballad of Sexual Dependency. It isn't dependency. It's slavery.
Which is quite a different thing,
right? I don't remember Marx's translation.
I think it was cleaned up also because they, after all, they made a recording.
It's a very, very raunchy song. And it has words in it that you're not supposed to say on the air or on stage, but you do, right?
Oh, also in our duet, The Pimp and the Whore, there was a time, and no, that one. There on the recording, well, first of all, they say, In that small 2x4 where we played, we kept saying, it says bordello. It says
in German.
So why not use that word? In our bordello where we both played. So in other words, we've also done a little bit of
doctoring.
Well, why don't we listen to that very song as done in the New York Shakespeare Festival recording. We'll listen to the way they handled it, which is, as you'll hear, a little different from both of those versions. And from my understanding of reading the liner notes from this album, I think it was Papp who suggested that a new translation be written for it, because when Blitzstein wrote it in, the 1940s?
Mm-hmm.
There were so many... there was so much censorship on the stage and in film that you really had to be careful what you said. Uh-huh. And if it wasn't kept very tame, then it wouldn't have been allowed to play. So consequently, Bordello could become Homer.
Two by four.
That's right. Okay, so this is from the New York Shakespeare Festival of the Three Penny Opera. The lyrics translated by Ralph Manheim and John Willett. And we'll be hearing Ellen Green and Raoul Julia.
A time now very far away when we set up together, I and she. I had the brains and she supplied the breast. I did her right and she supported me. A way of life then, if not quite the best. And when a client came, I'd slide out of our bed and treat him nice and go and have a drink instead. And when he paid up, I'd address him, sir, come anytime you feel you fancy her. The time's gone past, but what would I not give to see that whorehouse where we used to live?
That was a time now very far away. He was so sweet and bad. Kept me locked away all day, but came the night he brought acquaintances to play. When I object, he knocked me headlong down the stairs. I had the bruises off and on for years. The time's long past, but what would I not give to see that whorehouse where were you? Thank you.
you see, was generally booked up. The night's more normal, but daytime will do.
Once I was pregnant, so the doctor said.
So we reversed positions on the bed.
He thought his weight would make it premature.
But in the end, we flushed it down the sewer.
That could not last. But what would I not give to see that poor house where we used to live?
That was from the New York Shakespeare Festival production of the Threepenny Opera with a new set of lyrics provided by Ralph Manheim and John Willett. We heard Raoul Julia and Ellen Green singing that duet. With me, if you're just joining us, is Martha Schlama and Alvin Epstein, who were performing a Kurt Weill cabaret that they've brought to Philadelphia from New York, where they've been performing it. And here it's being performed at the Annenberg Center on Walnut Streets between 36th and 37th Streets. Well, that's a song that you sing and do differently within the cabaret. What do you think of those lyrics that we just heard?
Disgusting. Really, I can't tell you how I hate them. Because
I hate them.
I know them.
With all our apologies to all the lovely people involved.
Yes, I love the performers, and I don't know. It's very hard for me to understand why anyone would make such an unmusical translation and claim it to be more related to the German.
The big puzzle of the 20th century is, why did Joe Papp claim that he had commissioned a new translation because there wasn't a faithful enough one, and that this was the faithful translation? There was, before the show opened in New York, there was a big article, I think either by Joe or quoting him, in the amusement section of the Sunday Times, where this big apologia was made for this new translation, and where he printed side by side as an example of how faithful his new translation was. This was a man publicly hanging himself, you know, getting out there to show, look, everybody, look, watch me do this. He printed the lyrics of Instead Of, the Mark Blitzstein version, and then the new version by Manheim and Willett. Of course, he did not print the German alongside.
Which
Instead Of is exactly the translation of the German, which is Anstatt Das. Anstatt Das means nothing other than instead of.
Which is perfect.
And in English, in the new translation, it was no, you can't.
I mean, I don't mind if somebody feels that that's what they
Let
should say.
Let them call it,
Knacknissle,
that's right.
No, let them call it whatever they want, but don't say that that is the nearest to the German, because it's a total blatant lie, yes. We were both so incensed.
I mean, we couldn't figure out what the hell is this all about. Why? Why claim for it things that simply cannot support.
I mean, I'm always in favor of new translations if you can come up with something better and stronger. But the translation of this duet, it's incomprehensible, first of all. I don't understand.
It's very hard to understand.
Did you understand? I don't understand.
Well, I understood Raoul Julia very well, but Ellen Green in her falsetto range. Yeah.
Well,
really,
I think
that has something to do with the way she's singing. That.
Yes.
Well,
I'm not sure if it
has to do with how she's singing. I think it's those words that are very difficult to get around your tongue. They're not musically, they don't fit.
Do you remember the German of this, by any chance? Let's do an instant comparison.
In jener Zeit, die längst vergangen ist, lebten wir schon zusammen. Er und ich.
Yeah, all right. That's fairly close. Yeah. Here it says, there was a time, now very far away, when we set up together, I and she.
Yes, but that's darling, bad. That's bad
when
poetry.
When I set up together.
When we set up together.
It's you sat up, you mean all night? You sat up together all night because she had a sick headache?
No, we set sing, up house together.
I know, but you can't understand that when you're singing.
Yes.
We sing... There was a time,
and now it's all gone by,
when we two lived together, she and I.
Now that,
which is a much better sung lyric than this one, although it says the same thing.
Yes.
Ours is better.
Now, you must not, you have to give up, I think, some of the words in order to also be able to sing it musically. It does. It has to fit the music.
Do you remember the second line?
I'm not sure. Und als kein Zaster war, hat mich angehaucht.
No, you're singing your second from your verse, right?
I don't remember yours. Und als kein Zaster war, hat mich angehaucht. Da hieß es gleich, du, ich versetz dein Hemd.
Yeah, again.
Und als kein Zaster war,
when the cash ran out. Yes, yeah.
So he hat mich angehaucht. Which means he sort of breathed at me.
And then
hieß es gleich, I'm telling you, I'm going to pawn your shirt.
Yes. Well, that's very close. And when the cash ran out, the feathers really flew. He'd up and say, I'm going to pawn your skirt.
Yeah, well, but you try and sing it though.
I know. And we don't sing that
say
verse.
Say skirt, no.
What do we sing?
There was a time and now it's over when we were poor but happy, he and I. And when the night no customers would bring and we would fight, he'd yell, hey, give me back my ring. A ring is nice, no doubt. It's been done without.
Yeah.
And in German, it says, ohne geht es auch.
No skirt is okay, too.
Ohne geht es auch. This is perhaps closer, but it's unsingable, is what I'm saying.
Well, in this particular instance, it is closer.
Yes.
But in some of the other instances, it is not closer. So you can't use it as a
reason. As an example, no. But it's just shocking.
The last lines in this Shakespeare Festival version of it are about...
Flushing the baby down the toilet.
Yeah, and changing positions. He suggested we change positions in the
bed. I think when we did it in German, I did it at City Center, you know, in German. I think they leave out that third verse. I mean, it was too rough for anyone. Flushing that baby down the toilet. I mean, that is...
But what did you want to ask about that?
Yeah, if anyone who sings that verse or not.
Oh,
no,
yeah.
I don't remember doing that, either in London when I was very young or at the City Center production.
I'm going to say something that's going to be blasphemy probably to a lot of people listening now, perhaps to you too. But we had a simulcast between Channel 12 and WUHY of Mahogany on Tuesday night, which is the same night I heard you perform. So it was it was very exciting. I'd forgotten that this was on, and I came into the car and had the performance playing back in my head. Turned on the radio to WUHY, and there was Kurt Weill again. And I said, "All right, it's the simulcast of Mahogany," and it was the Metropolitan Opera Company.
Yes.
And it just didn't sound good to me. Okay, I said it. But the operatic quality, I couldn't understand some of the words. It didn't have that sense of being spit out that I think some of the lyrics should be. There's a certain directness in a non-operatic voice that sometimes a very trained operatic voice seems to lose. And I really felt that I was missing a lot.
It's such a problem. It really is a terrible problem. You see, I was a trained singer. And at the beginning of my attempting to sing Kurt Weill songs in my own programs, I was a folk singer. I was trained. It was a very sweet, high voice that was very Mozartian. And people used to say, it's too pretty for Kurt Weill. And my temperament is all right for Kurt Weill, but the vocal quality was not, as far as a lot of people were concerned. And I really changed. My voice became lower. The years make it lower anyway. And I've lost some of that lyrical quality, which I regret sometimes. But I needed to sing these songs more than I needed to retain the lyrical quality. Now, I'm trying to sing as well as I can, even now, even though I understand the style of the songs, that they don't need operatic sounds. But you know, the minute I'm singing correctly, so-called, like opera singers are trained, it ruins the style. It's just such a bloody problem. I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
It's very, very difficult to sing beautifully. And for instance, when I sing Lost in the Stars, I want to sing beautifully, you see. But because I have been singing like that all through the evening, it's very hard to get to the lyrical quality. So there is a problem. You give up something, you gain something. I don't know what they did. I haven't seen the Mahogany.
I saw it.
Alvin did. But I bet it must be very, very difficult for someone who is trained to sing on the vocal line, where the emphasis is on making beautiful sounds, to sing. Well, we've heard a recording of Shirley Verrett singing the song that we do, the life that we lead's not a long one. Well, she sings that song in German with the most glorious sound you can imagine, but it sounds as though she was saying, I'll meet you in Venice, Samantha. I swear to you, that's what it sounds like. And it's like
it's
the
like some 1947 rumba, you know, with Mantovani
absolutely
or Andre
meaningless.
Castellanos playing.
But the sound, I mean, I would kill to have that sound. And then I say, well,
and then what would you do with it?
Then I would sing a life that we lead.
Yeah.
No, I would abandon it, I suppose.
No, you have to go to the Metropolitan and sing Dialogue of the Carmelites.
Well, that's a problem.
We're out of time. The time has really flown. I've really enjoyed having you here, and I just loved the show. I'm so glad you brought it to Philadelphia, and I'm really glad that you came this afternoon for fresh air.
We like talking to you.
Oh, thanks.
Very much.
I've been speaking with Martha Schlama and Alvin Epstein, who are both in Philadelphia performing a Kurt Weill cabaret, which they also do in New York. They'll be returning to New York with it after its stay here at the Annenberg Center. The center is on Walnut Street between 36th and 37th. We're going to listen to a little bit now of Ira Gershwin singing with Kurt Weill. Now, we'll hear Kurt Weill at the piano, and we'll also hear him singing a little bit. This is one of their collaborations together. It was for something called The Firebrand of Florence, which opened with Lottie Lenya to very mixed reviews and closed after about 43 performances. It was actually supposed to be a parody period piece, and well, it was about a sculptor, and the critics apparently said it's about Cellini. Yeah, and the critics apparently said that it was so overdone, because the scenery and the costumes were so overdone that it became like a parody of a parody instead of just a parody. So it closed pretty quickly. We'll hear the opening from it with Ira Gershwin singing the lyrics that he wrote. You'll hear Kurt Weill at a couple of minutes or so into this, and you'll hear the change of voices, and he'll be singing Tots and Sweets and Tots and Sweets.
Act 1, Scene 1. A public square in Florence, spring, 1535, early morning. Cathedral bells are heard. The hangman sings. When the bell of doom is clanging, for the man awaiting hanging, let's face the fact with no misgiving. One man's death is another man's living. His assistants. One man's death is another man's living under the gallows tree. With union pay, we sing all day, the while our hammers bang. If the world doesn't like it, the world can go hang under the gallows tree. Ooh, riddly diddly dee, ooh, under the gallows tree. There are those who have me baffled. They refuse to choose the scaffold. To die in bed then hang they'd rather. Six of one, half a dozen of t'other.
One man's death is another man's living under the gallows tree. We earn our fee philosophically the while the hammers bang. If the world doesn't like it, the world can go hang under the gallows tree. Ooh, riddly diddly dee. Ooh, under the gallows tree. Couple of street vendors, come on.
Sweets and tarts. Get your sweets and tarts. Fill your stomachs and warm the cockles of your hearts. Sweets and tarts.
Second vendor. Hey, tart man, what's the idea? There's nobody here yet. First vendor. I was just warming up. Second. By St. Veronica, not a bad notion. And he sings.
Souvenirs. Hurry, 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 get your souvenirs. Souvenirs of the hanging of Cellini, the greatest hanging of the season. Get your likeness of Benvenuto Cellini. The occasion isn't complete without one. Souvenirs. Hurry, 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 get your souvenirs.
Count Matthew enters. How goes it, hangman? Hangman, almost ready, sir. Soon he'll bother you no more. Matthew, are you sure it'll hold? Hangman, I've never had a rope break on me yet, sir. Matthew, I want no slip-ups. It was only by a stroke of providence that I survived his murderous attack. And now I want to see him dangling there. And I won't feel safe on this earth until I do. Hangman, it's a great day for me too, sir. The most famous neck in Florence. But 'tis pity that with that neck passes a great talent. Matthew, bah, of sympathy I haven't any. He's tried to kill one man too many.
Sweets and tarts, souvenirs.
The crowd starts coming on.
Hurry, 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 get your souvenirs. Fill your stomachs, souvenirs of the hanging of Cellini. Warm your hearts, the greatest hanging of the season.
Hangman, what a day, what a turnout. Someone, what a turnout, what a hanging. Someone else, what a hanging, what a city. The crowd, what a city, what a city. They all sing. With nothing but pity, the folk we dismiss who live in a city that's other than this. If you're bent on viewing something doing, come to Florence. Where is life more active and attractive than in Florence? Where are people singing at a swinging but in Florence? Everything warrants our singing of Florence. Oh, Florence, we're singing of you. Everything warrants our singing of Florence. Oh, Florence, we're singing of you. There's artistic treasure none can measure here in Florence. Great is every statue looking at you here in Florence. And we've got a lot of terracotta here in Florence. Praises in torrents we shower on Florence. So Florence, you always come through. Girls, in all of Italy, no brighter star. We're sitting prettily right where we are. Men, don't mention Napoli, Venice or Rome. Florence sings happily, no place like home. If you're spending ducats by the buckets, you're in Florence. All the girls are busty, life is lusty here in Florence. And did you know that Dante and Chianti came from Florence? Oh, everything warrants our singing of Florence. Oh, Florence, we're singing of you. Everything.
What we've just heard is an excerpt of some of the music that was written by Ira Gershwin, who did the lyrics, and Kurt Weill, the music, for Firebrand of Florence, a production that was pretty short-lived, about 43 performances, I believe. We heard a little bit of Weill himself doing some of the singing on that. His was the voice that sang, sweets and tarts, sweets and tarts.